from Illinois, and then came back to Oxford and set up a synchrotron radiation program in the lab there, which I was not actually involved in, but other students were. But I didn't become involved until Fred Brown persuaded me to come over and work for the University of Illinois in 1980. So I started with Illinois in August of 1980.
You came over to Tantalus.
This was to build the beamline that went on to Aladdin, which was dismantled some years ago as being obsolete. There was not, it was a extended range grasshopper or erg beamline, and there was not that much demand for them, and we had several on the machine, so it was taken off to make way for something else.
Mm-hmm. When they say grasshopper, what does that one, what does that refer to?
The original grasshopper has a linkage between the diffraction grating and a slit mirror, which directs light onto the diffraction grating, and the linkage is mechanical, and it's two legs that come up like a grasshopper's legs. The extended range grasshopper, the legs would have had to have been something like, I think, 3 meters long, and it was decided this was getting to be impractical, so the linkage was done via computer-controlled stepping motors instead. That also gave you more flexibility, so you could have more than one diffraction grating and just use the motors to move one out of the way and use the other one, which is where it got an extended range as well as having a different energy range capability. You could actually have two overlapping energy ranges and get an extension.
So your primary role was construction of accelerator equipment, or did you do research?
At that point, well, we were building the beamline to do research, and a lot of the building had been done by the time I came in, so a lot of what I was involved in was assembly and testing and producing software to control the motors. And I have somewhere in my files a letter from Fred Brown saying I need to get over and get on the job quickly because Aladdin was going to start working in the summer of 1980. Which was a little bit off the mark. So we had the beamline built by 1983, at which point the funding for this that phase of it ran out, and there still wasn't a machine to connect the beamline to. And we wondered about putting it up on Tantalus. The Canadians took a regular grasshopper they had. One of the awkward things was that the beam in Tantalus and the beam in Aladdin are at different heights. And so if you wanted to take a beamline built for Aladdin and put it on Tantalus, you had to, I think, chop the legs off, basically, which was more trouble than you might wish to indulge in. They, anyway, did that and ran their beamline on Tantalus for some years. And we decided not to. We did then do some research on Tantalus, not a great deal, but some that had been sort of pending and could be done on Tantalus on one of the existing beam lines. And then, as I say, the funding ran out, and Ed Rowe hired me to work originally with Charlie Pruitt as the optics group, which was then the two of us. Previously it had been Charlie on his own. And we spent a little bit of time as an optics group. I guess I started in the middle of August, and something like the middle of October the optics group was dissolved and we became accelerator scientists, which Charlie already was, or had been, because there were not very many people on the payroll, and we needed everybody to try to work on making the machine work instead of doing anything connected with using it, because it was futile to have beam lines ready without a machine.
Yeah.
So that was the fall of 83, I guess. I found in the past that the odd year disappears. So we diddled around for a little bit, and eventually the National Science Foundation lost patience and cut the grant. But at that point, people had finally realized what was actually wrong, which was the ion trapping, and I don't know how much you know about that.
I've heard three accounts of the story, so I'm pretty versed in it. But Tell me a bit more of it.
Well, what actually happened at some point was that Ed Rowe realized that way back in the beginning they'd had similar problems with tantalus, and they'd put in clearing electrodes to get the ions out of the beam tube. And so he hastened up to tantalus and turned off the clearing electrode, and all of a sudden tantalus didn't work again. So then we rewired the beam position monitor electrodes to work also as clearing electrodes, and lo and behold, Aladdin started to work.
What were the electrodes that they used?
They were a beam position monitor. They were strip lines which, when the beam passes by them, there is an electrical signal induced in them. There's one each side, or one top and bottom. And you can, from the magnitudes of the signals in the opposing electrodes, work out where the beam is. Nowadays we've installed some that are also at 45 degrees, which the problem with the horizontal and vertical ones is the horizontal ones actually clip the beam and reduce the lifetime. So, but the electronics is more complicated if you put them at 45 degrees, because now you've got two electrodes that are doing the up-down, and the same electrodes differently arranged are doing the right-left, which is trivial to do nowadays. It was a bit more trouble to do in the early days. And so the ones they put in now are the 45 degree ones, which allow for a larger beam aperture. But then they don't work for clearing electrodes as well, so you have to put in additional clearing electrodes, which are usually a sort of a wire along the bottom of the beam pipe.
How did they use the beam position monitors to make it a clearing electrode?
Well, you just have to put a DC field. The clearing electrode works by putting a DC field so that the ions which are giving you the trouble are attracted across the beam pipe and sucked out of the beam, so to speak. And so with the clearing electrodes, you just have to make an arrangement which allows you to put a DC voltage on them to get the field, whilst allowing the AC signal that you were using to monitor the beam position to come out into the electronics that did that. The beam position monitor, that was another story. The beam position monitors were originally built into the machine because they knew they would need them, but nobody had had the time to actually wire them up. And so that was actually the first thing that I did, was to... It turned out Ed had borrowed a great stack of electromechanical relays from the Indiana Cyclotron project for this purpose. Because what you did in the crude and simple initial way that we did it was you built a whole tree of relays so that you had one detector and you could flip relays so that the signal from one electrode came to that detector. Then you flipped a relay to get the opposite electrode, then you got the one above and the one below, and then you went round to the next set of electrodes by flipping the relays, which was all done by a computer. And so we had these relays that he'd borrowed. The electrodes were already built into the machine. We used the most expensive possible way of monitoring the signals, solely because that was the piece of equipment we had, and we used a very expensive spectrum analyzer as a radio receiver, essentially, to get the signal out. And then the relays were controlled by a computer which also took in the signal from the spectrum analyzer. And the computer we used was one that Charlie had bought for the optics group, which we stole because there wasn't an optics group anymore, and we were only stealing from ourselves anyway. And that was used for many years. In fact, and the switching system was something, we had an LTE electronics technician, and he and I devised and built the controls for the switching, which were very temporarily built on sort of pegboard stuff with the intention that something more permanent would be done. That system was finally decommissioned 10 years later and had survived major changes in other parts of the system, but it lasted a lot longer than it had been intended to. And I forget how long it was before we took the $30,000 spectrum analyzer out of the thing and used something cheaper, but So that was presumably early 1984 when we got that system going. At least that's when it should have been. And that was also about the time that we got the mighty VEX 750 main computer. A thing which I think when we originally bought it possessed 4 megabytes of memory and some 450 megabyte hard disk and some removable platter 26 megabyte hard disks. That machine ran the particle accelerator, it ran all the accelerator modeling, and it did all the office work. Which tells you something about how inefficient modern computers are.
Yeah.
And we got a deal on that. It was only $100,000, and a megabyte of memory could be added for a mere $1,000. And I've forgotten how many $1,000 a 450 megabyte hard disk was, but we got another of those after a while.
So you were involved with the technological and computer sciences,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, largely.
And the programming?
That too. So the initial control system consisted of some crates made by an offshoot from Fermilab called Omnibyte. And the initial main computer was a PDP-1134, I think, which was not really adequate. Neither were the control computers either, of which there were three. And the worst thing of all was the interconnection between the main computer and the computers down on the machine floor, which was forever giving us trouble, because it was 16-bit parallel ports up and down with home kludged hardware to make the connection work over a distance of 100 feet or so. And we kept getting bad connections and all sorts. It turned out some of our problems had to do with the fact that when the building was built, the university did not put in any way of controlling the humidity. And so in the summer, electrical connections corroded. As did many other things, like bits of the magnets. The polished flat pads on which the surveying instruments sat rusted and things like that. Eventually the university was persuaded to put in humidity control, but it had to be done in a, and still is, in a very expensive way, because they had built the system wrongly to not have it. But that solved some of our problems. The major solution, however, was to build an entirely new system of low-level computers which used different technology for the connections so it didn't corrode. We bought a European standard connectors I specified for the backplane, which actually had pins that sealed rather than the edge connectors like boards and PCs. Where there is lots of air getting in, and if there's any moisture it corrodes. We had an intermediate phase in which we solved a lot of the problems by switching over from the parallel connections to using an Ethernet connection, and we bought a way of connecting Ethernet to the old microcomputers on the floor and then running Ethernet upstairs to the VACs. Which was the same Ethernet that everybody in the building could connect to and everybody in PSL, and then the VAX also was connected to what we had instead of the internet in those days, which was the high energy physics network, which was based on the DECnet protocol, which worked very nicely and meant we could send email to people at CERN, but we couldn't send email to people who were not on the high energy physics network. So where have we got to there?
Around what time was the High Energy Physics Network up and running?
We connected to it, I think, sometime in late 84. It had been up for a while at that point. And we only got to connect to it because although we weren't a high energy physics lab, PSL built lots of stuff for high energy physics labs, and so they qualified to connect to it. So we had essentially a phone line between here and Fermilab, so the entire lab's network connection was essentially a phone line. But since email didn't support attachments and was only what you could type, this wasn't too much of an obstacle. File transfers were a bit slow, though.
Could you describe some of the upgrades and changes to the control room itself? Did that undergo changes?
Yes. The original computer was the PDP-11, then we went to the VAX 750, then we went to a micro-VAX, then we went to VAX stations, which then there was, instead of one central one, there was one per console, and we went through several iterations of VAX stations before we finally switched to PCs, and I think it was sort of about the time when PCs finally became capable of doing that sort of thing, and the Digital Equipment Corporation was going out of business because it was being bought by Compaq. And so it was not going to be, it was A, much more expensive to buy their hardware, and B, it wasn't going to be possible for much longer. And then, of course, we've gone through many iterations of PCs over the years. I've forgotten when we switched from VAX stations to PCs, but it was it would be somewhere in the mid-90s. That comes with its own problems, because now you have to, instead of having all of your data going through one central computer, it's all going through various disparate computers, and you have to come up with ways of putting stuff you want to save in the right place and saving it and backing it up and all that sort of thing, which is much more easily managed on one real computer than it is on a slew of PCs. But on the other hand, the slew of PCs works out, at least in terms of purchase price, a lot cheaper, whether in terms of payroll costs is something people argue about a lot. There have been some changes at the lower end. The VME crates, which are down on the floor talking to the hardware, are still the stuff that we installed, and whenever that was probably started about 85 and took a couple of years. One of the things we achieved was to do this complete rebuilding of the control system without ever taking the machine out of service for very long, because we could move things over a bit at a time. So there was never any significant downtime while we completely replaced everything.
What did it take to replace everything?
Well, you'd have to obviously design a new computer configuration, assemble it, write the software for it, put it down in a rack, and we had to design, you know, the rack setup and where we put the computers. Then we had to figure out the wiring and how we did the breakout panels, which connect between the hardware and the computer, because a power supply will have, for instance, an analog input, an analog output, and several digital inputs and outputs, whereas your computer boards come with all analog inputs or all analog outputs. And so you have somewhere where 32 analog inputs are wired out to a back panel, and the analog inputs, outputs from all the power supplies, come to another panel, and you cross wire to spread them around. And that's all done with wire wrap wiring, because that was designed by the telephone companies to need no maintenance for 30 years, and I figured that was going to be a tolerable choice for the lifetime of a leading, which is starting to push it now, but we had some problems with ones that were not properly put together initially, but once you found bad ones and fixed them properly, it's been very reliable, and much more reliable than its previous system, which used an earlier form. It also used a telephone company interconnection system, but it was earlier form that was a bit prone to corrosion, and then they used the wrong sort of wire to make the connections, which didn't help, because it was designed for solid wire, and in some cases they used stranded wire, which meant that when you put the pressure on it, the strands just all wriggled out of the way, so it didn't connect properly. Such excitement, accelerator work made of.
So what were the main advantages to the switch to the new computer systems?
Well, much greater capability, because now we could connect up many more power supplies and other things that we needed to run the machine, and we could monitor more things than we could before. And the signals were cleaner because you could, with more computers, you could put them out closer to the hardware they were connected to, so there was less run of cable. Because the previous ones were three boxes in the middle of the ring, and so some of the cable runs were quite long. And then you could handle much more data because you had much more powerful computers. And using an industry standard backplane like that and industry standard parts. One of the things we went through was, well, this is a whole other story. When we realized we needed to upgrade the computers was at about the time that we were going through this upgrade study, of which you may have heard, in which people were drafted in from various national labs like Argonne and LBL to help us figure out what to do. As Ed liked to put it, they brought in... they said they were bringing in top accelerator scientists, which clearly meant we were bottom accelerator scientists. And the design for the control system that they were proposing was based on one at Lawrence Berkeley. Were proposing for the advanced light source. They hadn't actually built much of it at that point. Fortuitously, at that time, the National Synchrotron Light Source at Brookhaven was contemplating a control system upgrade, and so they sponsored a workshop to talk about ways of doing control systems, which I went to. And this was very instructive, because I began to realize that the Berkeley one didn't make a lot of sense. And was going to be a royal pain to build and make work. It used a lot of custom-made parts that Lawrence Berkeley said they would make for us. But if you needed more, then you had to hope they would make some more. And what came out of that was there was a system being used for part of the Linac system at Fermilab that struck me as being more sensible. Now, their version of that still required some custom parts, although they provided us with the drawings to make our own printed circuit boards so we could make our own things. But I came to the conclusion we didn't need those either. We could do it all with industry standard stuff. And the biggest change... well, okay. The LBL system communicated by a much huger version of essentially the system we'd originally had, with these parallel links feeding up a tree of computers until they finally reached one main computer and then fanned out. Fermilab were using a network like Ethernet, but they decided that Ethernet had timing problems because Ethernet is not time determinate. It works by, if you want to send us some information across the Ethernet, your computer looks to see if it's busy, and if it's busy, it waits until it isn't busy. And so when you push a button, you can't say, actually within, sometimes if things are really bad, within seconds, but certainly within milliseconds, when that will go out. And it may not be you pushing a button, it may be a computer generating a command where milliseconds matter, might matter. But I looked at the numbers and I decided that wasn't an issue and we could actually use Ethernet. And that meant we didn't need to build their homemade things for talking on the token ring network and on another thing, which was a military network called 1553, which was going to be used for small computers to talk to smaller computers down at the ring level. So that meant everything we used was industry standard hardware. There are ways of working around the indeterminacy of the timing on Ethernet. In fact, the only thing where timing matters for us is when you do the machine ramp in energy, because you have to have all the power supplies moving together. And so, okay, when you push the button, you don't know how long it will take for the command to go out. And if what you send out is 30 commands to the different power supplies to ramp, then you could well get quite a lot of scatter and things not working. But there's also on Ethernet a thing called multicast, in which you can send one message to lots of things. And so if you use that, it doesn't really matter when the ramp starts within a short period of time. You don't want it to take minutes or hours, but as long as it starts within seconds of you pushing the button, that's okay. You just need all of them to go at once. And so if you send them a multicast message saying, okay, you guys all go, then when that goes out, they all receive it, and they all go. And you could have solved any other timing problems that you had similarly, but that was really the only one that was material to us. And then again, as I said, that meant it was all industry standard hardware. And that meant whenever something newer and better came out, industry was doing the work to develop it, and all we had to do was to come up with a few tens of thousands of dollars to buy it. And so then we could go through upgrades, and because we were using an industry standard backplane interconnect that's still in use, you can go out and buy modern cards and just plug them in and write the software to use them. And bingo. So basically the boxes and the wiring are the same ones that we put in 1985-ish, 5, 6, whatever. But most, and some of the hardware is still the same, because some, you know, something that just turns a digital signal on and off or monitors a digital signal hasn't improved, but some things have improved, and particularly the processor boards have improved, so those have all gone through several iterations of replacement. And then the software in the control room, funnily enough, in many ways it looks exactly as it did when the things were first installed, and I guess the control system was first up and running about 1980 and was based on a Fermilab system devised by the same people who built the microcomputers. Omnibyte Corporation was a Fermilab offshoot run by, lost their names, but I could find them, Michael Shea and Robert Goodwin. And so they provided, their private company built the equipment and peddled some Fermilab devised software to run those. And then the Fermilab software that talked to them was also used, and I'm not sure whether that was purchased or whether that was a freebie, but a guy called Tom Moog, who was a programmer at PSL, modified it to work here. And then when we bought the VAX, he ported it over. He did a sort of rough and ready port from the PDP-11 to the VAX, and then I rewrote it to actually work properly, because what he'd done was basically, the VAX had a compatibility mode in which it would pretend to be a PDP-11, and so he just fixed a few things that needed fixing to use that mode, and what I did was rewrite it to work in the VAX native mode. And then I was also doing some maintenance on the software that ran the microcomputers down on the floor, and I wrote the new code to run with the new VME crate microprocessors, which were a different microprocessor. At that point, when we were using Motorola 68000s in the VME crates, it was 6800s, which was, although there's only one digit difference, was actually a wholly alien architecture of processor. So that was a complete rewrite and redesign of the software to run on the VME crates. And somewhere in there we hired our first programmer, whose name was Martin Fried, who I think went off into finance. I don't know where he is now, probably responsible for the collateralized debt obligations or something, but anyway. And so he picked up some of the programming work. And then when he left, Dave Isaac came, and he's been doing it ever since. And he, at some point, I don't know whether he ever did much, because we were also providing support for the office, secretarial support. I don't know whether he ever did any of that. I sort of We didn't have a whole lot to do at that point because they were using the VAX and we had everything pretty much working and nothing involved. And they were all happily writing, well not happily, but they were writing documents in LaTeX, which is not a secretarial thing and you may never have heard of it. It was devised by a mathematician for writing scientific papers and in putting formulae and things in them, which you couldn't readily do with something in the early word processing software. But anyway, I think I started doing such as that to be done there so that Dave Isaac could concentrate on control system stuff. And then we made the fatal mistake. Well, it wasn't a fatal mistake, I suppose, but it was more of a pain than we had possibly have imagined, of deciding it was time to switch to PCs. And this was back in MS-DOS days. And that wouldn't have been so bad. MS-DOS worked okay, clunky as it was, and people were using WordPerfect because that was the predominant thing on campus at the time. But the fatal mistake was the fact that we'd been used to having everything networked, and so of course we wanted the PCs networked, and networking under MS-DOS was a royal pain. And I've often thought that Bill Gates should have been taken out and shot as an enemy of the people for keeping MS-DOS going so long. But we did manage to sort of make it work, and eventually Windows came along. And I had high hopes for Windows NT because it was actually originally based on, essentially on the VAX VMS operating system, which was a sensible operating system that didn't require rebooting several times a day. In fact, it didn't require rebooting hardly ever. Systems would run for years without a reboot as long as they were on a UPS and the power didn't go off. Unfortunately, in order to make Windows work compatibly with earlier versions of Windows, when they produced Windows NT, they kludged it and made it nearly as unreliable as MS-DOS. It has improved somewhat over the years, but it was never as good as the prototypes that they abolished. So anyway, then that became a much more time-consuming operation, which eventually, I guess we got it under control. Eventually we migrated to fairly stable versions of Windows. And then, of course, idiots discovered the internet. And so now most of the work goes into dealing with viruses and worms and general plagues that really should not be there at all. Plus the usual mess of software that doesn't work as it should and loses all your data and hardware failures and things like that. But it's probably, if you didn't have the viruses and worms and things, it would be a lot easier to run the computers now than it was in the early days of MS-DOS. But they've sort of, Microsoft software has gotten marginally better, but other things have come along to make life hard, so Pete is kept fairly busy by that sort of thing. As a sideline, at that point, it became apparent that the entire site needed a new telephone system. They'd had a telephone system put in around about 68-ish, I think, and they had formed various committees to try to figure out what to do about a replacement. They had tried to get advice from the telecommunications people on campus, who mostly said, it's too hard, you shouldn't attempt to do it yourselves, and we're too busy. They didn't offer any other advice. So eventually Esther nailed me and said, could I deal with this problem? And I thought, well, we've got the PCs all going now and life is easy, I probably have time to do this, which turned out to be not true. But anyway, we did eventually get that done. But that carried with it some ancillary baggage, because one of the complications here is we have to do internal telephone bill rebilling. So we have to collect all the information about calls people make and what the telephone company bills us for the calls and pass that on to their accounts. You can pay people to do that, but we decided we'd save money and do it ourselves. In order to do the first iteration of voicemail, we actually bought a fax, because at that point digital equipment was selling a voicemail package based on a fax, and since I knew how to run faxes, I could do the telephone bill data collection and processing on the fax quite nicely. And that worked quite well for a while. And we sailed right through Y2K. And then in the summer of 2001, I think it was, the software stopped working. It had got built into it something that said it wasn't good after July 2001, which we solved by putting the computer back to 1992, I think, and running with a fake date and time thereafter. But then I think the software ran into some other problems or was about to. In any case, digital equipment stopped supporting the voicemail stuff long before we gave up on it. And this was all about 1992 when we did put in the new telephone system. And I used that after, we kept that system up until, actually after I retired, I guess. I'd retired in 2005, and I think it was about 2006 when we finally switched to. It turned out AT&T, from whom we bought the phone system, although they became called several other things in the meantime, I think they're called Avaya at the moment, but I'm not sure, had produced a voicemail system. The one they had at the time was actually about as expensive as doing the VAX, and the VAX gave us some of the capabilities, so it seemed like a good way to go. But about 6 months after we bought our system, they came up with a much cheaper voicemail system that would have been a much better bet. And so when we finally gave up on the VAX-based one, we managed to find one of the new as they were in 1992 ones on the surplus market cheaply. So they got a new voicemail system relatively cheaply, not that anything's cheap in telephone equipment. But then they had to start doing the telephone bill processing on a PC, and that was painful too. That was all Pete's worry, so that didn't cause me any grief. Actually, I guess it wasn't after I retired. It was after I stopped being responsible for doing things with the computers and went back to doing things with the accelerator, which was, I don't know, that must have been about 2002, something like. The main thing I did from then on was dealing with running accelerator models to compare them with the real machine and figure out how to make the real machine into the ideal machine that we had designed. Which allowed us to both improve the performance of the old Aladdin design and then also to develop and get working the LF15 lattice that we use most of the time now. Which, the problem is that when you build an accelerator, none of the equipment is perfect, of course, and none of it's in the right place either, and you can never get it perfect or in the right place, so what you have to do is have ways of figuring out what's wrong with it and making adjustments that deal with the wrongness. And so there is software available that can be used to do that, and you make measurements of the way the beam behaves when you kick it in various ways and compare these with how it should behave, and you can work out from that what to twiddle. And so that was what I was doing for some years before I retired, while Pete had taken up worrying about computers. So that sort of gets us up to the present.
A great little history there, actually.
And there are probably a lot of gaps in there.
Well, it's definitely behind the scenes. That's what I've been looking for now, is behind the scenes of how things came about.
Yeah.
So that should give me enough for now. If I'm sure I'll have questions.
Well, right. I need to find some gaps and have some questions and compare it with other people's stories and find they're quite inconsistent.
Yeah.
See what we can resolve.
All right.
I do have some files that will probably allow me to fill in dates and names and things if need be.
On a rainy day.
On another rainy day, yes. Or a day when...